I'd like now to welcome Bruce Feiler. He's the author of the new book, The Secrets of Happy Families. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's lovely to be with you again.
It's nice to be with you, too. And I really enjoyed this book. I don't usually do books like this on my show, but let's talk about the title for a second, which is from the first lines of Anna Karenina, namely, all happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And I remember reading Anna Karenina many years ago and thinking, this is just not true. Maybe even the opposite. And you started doing a lot of research on happy families, and I wondered, what's your take at this point on Tolstoy's line?
Well, let me just, first of all, thank you for your kind words about the book. And I do think that's a great place to begin. And I, like you, when I first read it when I was a teenager, I thought, and this is a technical word, I thought it was idiotic, right? At least the first half, of course all happy families are not alike. Some are big, some are small, some are loud, some are quiet. But what's interesting is in the last 10 years or so, for the first time, we have the knowledge and the ability to answer that question. So if you look at, say, the positive psychology movement, right, it's about 10, 12 years old at this point. And the key idea of the positive psychology moment was, let's don't just look at individuals who are dysfunctional. Let's look at individuals who are working and find out what we can learn from them. And that technique has just started to be applied to families. I think it wasn't really 5 years ago, but now it has been. And so for the first time, we have the tools to begin to answer that question. And that really is the question I was trying to answer when I set out on this project, which is, what do happy families do right, and what can I learn from them to make my chaotic, sometimes happy, sometimes out-of-control family even happier? So, yes, I'm prepared to stand up now and say I think that Tolstoy was right, that you can identify certain building blocks that high-functioning families have, how they recover from setbacks, how they communicate with one another, what they do right. So I think Tolstoy, after all these years later, was correct.
Now, you set out to explore that whole question and specific things like why it is that getting out of the house in the morning and going to bed at night and meals and basically the routines of family life can become battlegrounds for so many families. And you asked experts in many fields, as you've been talking about, and found that in general, therapists were the least helpful. Why is that?
Well, I think that, you know, we're 100 years after Freud, and a lot of people obviously have been helped by therapy, but to a certain extent, we're hearing the same ideas over and over again. And in particular, I think that what's frustrating is that parents are in this straitjacket that the only ideas we're allowed to implement must come from the family improvement industry, these shrinks and self-help gurus and other experts, whereas we're not really hearing new ideas in that space. And at the same time, as you know, in almost any other area of contemporary life, from business to sports to the military to Silicon Valley, social networking, et cetera, there is a tremendous amount of new know-how about how to make teams and groups function effectively. So one of the core ideas of this book was, I didn't want to talk to therapists. I did want to talk to these people in these other worlds. What are you guys doing at home? What are you taking at home to make your mornings less stressful? What are you talking about at dinner, or if not dinner, if you can't make dinner? What are you doing on vacations? I went, for example, to the folks at Zynga who design online games. You guys think about games for a living. I'm tired of playing 20 questions. It's a 100-year-old game. Why am I doing that on the long car ride with my kids and they're screaming in the back seat? So tell me what you've learned about designing games to make my long car rides more interesting.
Okay, so tell us. What games do you play in the car?
Well, right now, one of the things I learned from the Zynga guys is that boys like competition, right? So they like a lot of points and scores and level up and all this kind of stuff, whereas girls like decorating, which is why Farmville, for example, is so popular. They like storytelling. So I have daughters, so we do a lot of storytelling games where, okay, see the person in that car. Tell me where they're coming from and where they're going. And you start the story, and then we're going to pass it on to your sister and then pass it on to your mom, and we're going to pass it on to me. That's one example. They taught me a game called The Amazing Race, which was modeled on the TV show The Amazing Race, which we now do on weekends and on long trips. We did one in Santa Fe a year ago. We were visiting a friend, and we said, okay, we're going to have a three-day amazing race, and you're going to get points for trying new foods. You're going to get points for my girls are naturally shy, so getting over your shyness and going to ask directions from somebody on the corner. We got them. We had an incredibly pleasant 90 minutes at the George O'Keefe Museum. I could never get my kids in art museums before. By running around, playing games, identifying colors in photos or what photo is your favorite. And what was interesting was I was reluctant to make them lose or to get something that they didn't succeed at, but that actually motivates kids more, we now know from games. So here's a very simple idea. There are people who think about this. You can make your weekend more effective. You can play smarter.
There are some examples of business practices that have been adapted to families with remarkable efficacy. You have a chapter on agile practices. What are some of those practices?
From the 30,000-foot level of Mary Schwartz, there are basically three large things that happy families do based on what I've learned. Number one, they adapt all the time. Number two, they talk a lot. And number three, as we've been saying, they go out and play. But let's just start with that adaptability. We know that stress is the number one problem that families have, and we also know that kids now know that their parents are incredibly stressed. And I thought as a parent that I would set a couple of three rules, we would stick to them, and it would all work out. Turns out it's not that simple. And you need to adapt all the time. Well, who's better at this? The answer is there's this idea called Agile. It began in Japan in the 80s, came to Silicon Valley, and is now sweeping through management suites across the country. And the core idea is, instead of having an executive who issues orders that the entire team then spends 2 years trying to implement, and then you come back 2 years later with a product that's out of date, over budget, and irrelevant, you say, okay, don't do something that's going to take me 2 years. We're going to design a cell phone or a search engine or a new product. You say, go design me one element, then come back in a week, and let's talk about it. Let's adapt. Let's see how it's doing. This idea is called Agile. The idea is you succeed or fail quickly, and you're constantly reviewing everything along the way. A lot of parents began doing this in homes, and this Agile movement popped up, which I have tapped into, and we now use a number of these techniques in our family, as a lot of smart families I found are doing. Number one, we have a checklist in the mornings where the parents don't do the checking off, right? Parents, instead of saying, brush your teeth, make your bed, as we do every morning, we were doing it around here. We now have a list. These are things that you're expected to do, and the kids have to do the checking off. But the biggest thing that we've done, and this may be the single biggest thing we've done to improve our family, is we now hold a weekly meeting where we spend 20 minutes saying what worked well this week, what didn't work well, what will we agree to work on in the week ahead. And we let our kids get involved in identifying things to work on, because frankly, what we were doing in September is irrelevant to what we need to be doing in April, because maybe mom's got a business trip this week, maybe one kid has a big sporting event, or another one has a play at school. You need to be able to adapt all the time. And if you're doing it all the time, if you're fighting over the broccoli on Tuesday or the curfew on Thursday, you don't have time you don't want to be resolving that conflict in the middle all the time. You want to have this safe zone at the end of the week where you can be mindful about what it means to be part of our family.
So what does that mean? When you have a conflict, you just don't deal with it and say, well, we'll work on that on Sunday?
To a certain extent, yes. I mean, you have to do what you need to do to get through the conflict at the moment, but then you don't just let it rest at that point. You say, okay, I mean, one of my daughters came to me recently, and my girls will be 8. We've been doing this now for over 3 years in our family. She came to me recently, and she said, my sister, it was my turn to have that chair, and she had that chair, and you've got to tell her to stop. And my response was, I'm not going to do that now. Bring it up in the family meeting. So when we had the meeting, we did it on Sunday. What didn't work well, she brought it up, that it was my day to have that chair. And I mean, it couldn't have been a pettier argument, but whatever it was, that's what was bothering them at that moment. So now we need a new way. So we had a system in place where one kid got to have a day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the other Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, or whatever it was. And on that day, they could pick whatever they're going to whatever seat they're going to have. They could go first in music practice, whatever it was. And it wasn't working. So we changed it. So we came up with a new system whereby certain people get certain days to do this and certain people do certain days to do that. The point is, you're adapting. You're having a safe zone where everybody talks about how you're working as a family. And here, again, here's the big picture from my point of view, and that is we have this idea that families just are. They can just be. But that doesn't work. We work on our jobs. We work on our hobbies. We work on our bodies. We can do small things to improve our families. And if you think that it might have been better in the old days with mom, dad, or grandparents, well, guess what? They used to smoke then. They used to drink then. They used to ride bikes without helmets and put kids in cars without car seats. We can take advantage of new knowledge. We do it in every other area. We need to be more conscious and more open and welcome these ideas into the family.
We're talking to Bruce Feiler about his book, The Secrets of Happy Families. It's interesting that you said that about, because that's a family that I grew up in, smoking and drinking and all kinds of things that people don't really do so much now and certainly are more conscious of in families. But I was thinking there are a lot of different things that make life more stressful for both parents and children. And one of them is just the ubiquity of many, many media. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think that that's right. I mean, I think that there have been a lot of changes in the family. One is the definition of a family. It's not just a nuclear family anymore. We have blended, adopted, gay, straight, nuclear families in separate houses, divorced families in the same house. What it means to be a family has changed. Women are working a lot more, of course, two-thirds of women working outside the home. And also dads are much more involved in parenting than they were even 5-10 years ago. So we're seeing a lot of changes. And I think that what's happening also is this kind of new generation of parents is being more active and saying, I want to take that, those ideas, that efficiency, that intelligence that I'm seeing in my workplace, and I want to bring it to home. And one of the problems with that is technology. Now, I'm a big believer that technology is neutral, so that there are pros and cons to technology. So busy moms in the workplace can check in with their kids. It's sports practice to make sure it's going okay. Also, dads can leave work early, or maybe it's moms, to coach a sporting event and check in at the office on the way home. So there are advantages. My parents live in Georgia. My dad's ailing and can't travel. They were Skyping with my children in Brooklyn over the weekend. There's technology being helpful, bringing families closer. But more often than not, it's dividing families. And there's a tremendous amount of research that every week, I just saw a study even last week, that will send chills down your spine. I met with a professor at Stanford who basically told me that between the ages of about 8 and 15, children learn to read nonverbal communication from the people around them. If you're crossing your arms and when you're tired, when you're not paying attention, when your story's gone on too long, whatever it might be. And because our kids are looking in devices so much, they are not developing that skill. So technology can be fantastic, but you simply must, as a parent, put limits. And even more important, make sure that there is face time to balance off that device time to make sure your kids are being able to develop these human interpersonal skills that are vital to them when they get older.
We have in Santa Fe done a turn off your TV week, which then morphed into a turn off your screens week, where parents and children make a commitment to not doing any screen time at all, unless it's in school or for work or whatever, you know, it's an obligation, but no recreational screen time at all. And what they found was parents and children were getting to know each other and talking more profoundly about things, and they really liked it, and some even continued it, or it changed the way their habits were.
We basically don't allow recreational screens except during the weekends. The weeks are just too busy, and there's too much going on with school and homework and bathing and piano practice, etc. There's another way of looking at this. I like the idea of a week off, but if it's 51 weeks on, then, you know, there are downsides to that as well. Maybe it does change patterns. But here, let's just talk about dinner for a second, okay? There's a tremendous amount of knowledge. And if there's one thing the parents have been told, it's that dinner is important with your family. And there, in fact, is a ton of research to back that up. But here's the problem. It doesn't work with a lot of our schedules. My wife doesn't even come home till 6:30 at night. The kids have sports practice. There's play practice, whatever it might be. But you dig deeper, and I think there's a lot of interesting and kind of relieving news for families in there. And that is, it turns out, I mean, nothing has been more studied than dinner. And there's only 15 minutes of conversation in any mealtime. I mean, 10 to 15 minutes. The rest is taken up with take your elbows off the table and pass the ketchup. The headline here is you can take that 15 minutes and move it to any time of day and still have the benefit. So maybe it's family breakfast is more suited to your schedule. Maybe it's a bedtime snack at 8:30 after everybody's home and spend some time doing their own thing, kids are doing their homework, whatever it is. So one way of doing it is to say, okay, we want to make a commitment that we're going to have 15 minutes of family time every day. You can have a serious conversation. You can play a game. You can just sit, play a simple game, say bad and good, where everyone talks about what happened bad in their day that day, and everybody talks about what happened good in their day that day. Parents and children, bad and good. I thought as a parent, oh, let's only accentuate the positive, but the truth is that's not preparing kids for the hardship. So if you talk about your own bad times, that's signaling to them, you know, mom and dad struggle also, and when you struggle, this will help give you the skills to succeed. So turn off devices for a week. Maybe that'll change your habit. But another way to do it is to make sure you have 15 minutes of bonding time every single day.
Well, one of the main takeaways for me from your book was the understanding that parents' crucial role, main role, besides loving their children, is to train them to be adults, to be responsible and successful adults. And this includes learning from you, learning responsibilities. And you talk about ethical decision-making and making compromises and so on. And when you do this, I would think every parent is going to be coming up against their own limitations, the ways in which they're not so strong. And when you do that, how do you handle it? When you find ways in which you're just not good, you don't know how to be a role model for your kid.
Well, first of all, it's just much more realistic. And there's this idea that parents have that we're supposed to know it all and we're supposed to have all the answers. We don't have all the answers. And part of what I have learned as a parent is to be open about that. We, as you know, in one of the chapters that's been most talked about in The Secrets of Happy Families has been the one, and you've alluded to it a few times, about making a family mission statement where we sat down and set about to identify the values that are most important to us. And I originally thought this was corny, but then someone said, can your kids identify the values that really mean the most to you? And I thought, well, I haven't really told them. So we created this mission statement, and now hangs in one of downstairs in where we eat dinner. And a few weeks later, we got a call from the school that one of my daughters had gotten into a spat with a classmate. So we had that pant, oh, God, do we have a mean girl? All those questions that people fear about. And the truth is, we didn't know what to do. And we called, we felt we had to do something. We called my daughter into my office, was kind of using it as the principal's office. We just talked about what happened. And then my wife, kind of grasping at straws, that mission statement, we had just done it and still in sketch form. It was hanging on my wall and like on a flip chart. And my wife said, anything up there seemed to apply? And my daughter looked it down and she said, we bring people together? And boom, suddenly we had a way into the conversation because we had articulated this is the family we want to be. We certainly don't achieve it all the time, but it was, we know that if you articulate your best possible self or the weight you want to lose on a diet or the marathon you want to run, if you identify what your goal is, you're more likely to achieve it. And that's what this family mission statement achieved. And it was an example of that. There is no way. I can guarantee you, Mary Charlotte, I'm going to face a situation this weekend with my children that I have never faced before. And what we have with the meeting, what we have with this mission statement, what we have now is an understanding that when it comes up, we're going to sit down and talk about it, and we're not going to just simply pretend that we know exactly what we're doing as parents.
We're talking to Bruce Feiler about The Secrets of Happy Families, his new book. And one of the things that I think is also very important in this book and very interesting is the importance of the family narrative, namely having kids know where they come from, what this cast of characters of the family is in their larger world, not just mom, dad, or mom, whatever, and the nuclear family.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I agree with you. To me, when I look back at the book now, I think it is the most interesting idea, perhaps, in The Secrets of Happy Families. I write this column, as you know, in the New York Times on families every month, and I wrote about this last month. It's been the most emailed piece in the New York Times for the last month. And the idea is this, is that you want to talk to your kids about what it means to be part of your family. Researchers at Emory gave kids a do you know test. Do you know where your grandparents were born? Where your parents went to high school? A aunt or an uncle who had an illness that they overcame? And the kids who knew more about their family history had a higher degree of confidence and a greater sense that they could control their lives. It was the single biggest predictor, number one, of a child's well-being. And as the researchers explained to me, kids have the sense that they're part of a larger narrative, that everything doesn't just go great, everything doesn't just go horrible, they're kind of ups and downs, an oscillating family narrative is the academic term, that they understand so that when they hit their inevitable rough patches, instead of thinking they're the only ones who've hit it, they're going to quit they're just going to fail the test or quit the sports team or whatever hurdle they're facing, if they think, oh, I remember when my aunt had breast cancer and she went through it and now she's fine, or I remember my grandfather lost his job, or we had to spend a year not really celebrating the holidays because we were having some financial difficulties. Our instinct is to lock those skeletons in the closet, and if I've learned one thing, it's to flee open the doors, share that information. Every single family, every single person listening to us today has an Uncle Joe or an Aunt Susan or a brother who's maybe got a drinking problem or whatever it is that they are shielding from their children. And I've learned to be much more open. It's against almost every instinct I have, but I have been so deeply persuaded that it's in my children's best interest to be open about who we are as a family.
I was reading through the book and I was thinking, this stuff is really very important, and it has kind of a feel of a book that middle-class families are going to read and use. But what if you come from a really, truly broken family where, I mean, we have here in northern New Mexico, three generations of drug addicts families and a lot of violence in the family and so on. And if your family narrative is predominantly negative, what do you do with that?
I mentioned before that I had written about this family narrative idea in the New York Times a few weeks ago. And I was flooded with emails, and including a number from therapists, one at Columbia, one at Yale, who are doing research into broken families and into families where there is difficult. And they were specifically focused on the attachment between parent and child and the ability of shifting that family narrative, the power of research. I just happened to be looking at it last night, so it's very fresh in my mind. Research into the power of family, the power of individuals to be able to shift their family narrative. This is not something that is guaranteed. If you've come from a difficult family, if you have divorce in your family, if you have some of these addictions that you alluded to, you can change. That really is the thing that I have learned, is that the way I went about this book was, instead of looking at lots of different ways families are structured, I looked at the things that all families face. You mentioned it: mornings, dinner, talking to your kids about a healthy attitude toward sex, talking to your kids about a healthy attitude toward money, sports, travel, family reunions. These are things that all families have in common. Are there ways that you can learn from the people who are doing it right to make your situation? I mean, sex is a very, very good example. The more parents talk to their children about sexuality in an age-appropriate way, starting not when they're 10 with the idea of the talk, but when they're 18 months old, the American Academy of Pediatrics says, using proper names. When they're 8 and 10, talking to them about actual, putting real words and having tough conversations. The more parents engage, particularly fathers and daughters, you can delay the onset of sexual activity. So the more you use narrative, the more you talk about what it means to be part of a family, it will help your family, and you can even go a pretty far distance in breaking some of the patterns that you alluded to.
Very interesting. Let's talk for a moment about fighting. There's a very interesting chapter in the book about having fights, and often fights that we have within our families are about seemingly trivial and apparently very trivial things. You bring the model of negotiation into family conflicts. What does that look like?
I went and took a 3-day course from the folks at the Harvard Negotiation Project and said, you deal with Israelis and Palestinians or nuclear arms treaties. What have you learned from them to help my family? And it's a tremendous amount. And there is, again, a lot of knowledge that we can bring here. For just a couple of ticking things off the top of my head, my wife and I used to have the 7:42 fight where we would discuss who's picking up the milk and who's buying the tickets for Thanksgiving. Turns out the highest stress time in families is between 6 and 8. So lesson number one, don't have your difficult conversations between 6 and 8. We vowed no longer to do it during those hours. I was sitting at my desk at a high chair with my computer equipment. My wife was down below in an old swivel chair. Awful. Turns out I'm in the power position. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a power position, but I was making her resentful because I was lording over her, in effect. We now use a watered-down version of the Harvard technique with our kids. When they're fighting, let's say recently they were fighting over a card game. Kind of, it has three steps. Step number one, separate them. In negotiation speak, this is go to the balcony. Go to the balcony, look back on the stage of the fight, and get some perspective. Calm down, get a macro view. Step number two, move the spotlight. Come up with alternatives. So we make our kids come up with two or three alternatives to whatever thing they're fighting over. For the first 3 or 4 minutes, they insist that their solution is the only solution. Happens every time. But eventually, they'll relax. They'll come up with another solution to the card game or the fights or who's sitting where in the car ride. Then we bring them back together. At that point, there's 5 or 6 solutions on the table. Usually there's an overlap, and they're going on their day. So, again, the point is, just like we said, you don't smoke anymore when your kids are pregnant. You don't put your kid in the bike without a helmet. We can take advantage of this know-how. What I've tried to do in The Secrets of Happy Families is just bring all – who has time to go talking to all these things? The answer is it's this crazy way I live my life. So I've gone off and gotten all this information and tried to bring it into one resource for parents.
Now, another thing that I thought was fascinating was that you often can let kids decide their own punishment. If they know they've done something wrong, they get to decide what it is. And a lot of times, they're harsher than you would have been.
Every family that does this, Mary Charlotte, and I've talked to dozens, their kids are more strict than they imagine. Every family who's never done it has said, oh, my kids will be too lax. Oddly, it doesn't work that way. And not, I mean, I said oddly, but maybe that's not really what I mean, because this is what we now know. There's a tremendous, this new body of research in the last few years that shows kids who are setting their own schedules, making their own goals, evaluating their own progress. We know from brain scans, they're actually building up their prefrontal cortex, and they're developing these skills, these agency skills, executive skills they're called, that they will need later in life. And that really is the point. You can't just get your kid to 16 or 18 and say, go forth and make your own decisions. You got to give them practice along the way when the stakes may seem huge to them, who's sitting in which chair, but at the end of the day, it's not that huge. You want to give them the skills. Again, park that helicopter. You're not helicoptering is not helping anybody. You're just doing it because you're out of time and you're impatient. You want to empower your children as much as possible.
We're talking to Bruce Feiler. You know, just as when you're a little kid, you can learn foreign languages very easily and speak them without an accent and understand them for the whole rest of your life, in the same way, if you teach your kids, for example, about money when they're little kids and open to other kinds of language learning, it's not just foreign languages, but it's all the different kinds of languages of being an adult that you are talking about in this book. And money, in a way, is its own kind of language. And what you do with it and how you spend it and how you save it is something that can really be taught and experimented with at quite a young age.
80% of children get to college without ever having a conversation with their parents about money, how it's spent, how it's earned, how it's lost, what debt is. It's shocking. And I went to see Warren Buffett's bankers because I figured that he was talking to rich families, he would be smarter. In fact, he said the opposite. The richest families are sometimes making the worst mistakes. He He said, I told the richest woman in America recently, you have to talk to your kids about money. And she said, well, I don't want to burden them. And he said, burdening them with the truth is a lot less serious than burdening them with ignorance. And in fact, he chided me for the mistakes we were making with allowance. So after looking at all this research, we made a very firm decision. We give allowance to our children. We don't pay for chores, okay? Because, sorry, someone's got to make your bed. Someone's got to clear your table. I'm not going to do it. You're part of the team. You need to do it. I'm not going to pay you to set the table because the research shows you'll just do it for the money. But we were being kind of heavy-handed as parents about what we wanted our kids to do with their allowance. And he said, that's a big mistake. You should let your kids experiment. And I said, but what if they make a mistake? Or what if they don't have money when they want to buy something a few weeks later? They're wasting it on ice cream or candy. What if they drive into a ditch? And Buffett's banker said to me, it's one of my favorite lines in The Secrets of Happy Families. He said, it's much better to make a mistake with a $6 allowance than a $60,000 a year salary or a $6 million inheritance. And I just fell back in my chair. I was like, oh, that makes so much sense. It makes so much intuitive sense. You want to let your kids experiment when you're around to help, as opposed to when they're calling you at 24 that they're broke or they don't have enough money to buy a mattress to sleep on or whatever it might be. You want to give your kids room and space to experiment, to learn, and yes, to make their own mistakes.
Now, one of the single greatest stresses on families now is economic stress, and we have this ridiculously unfair distribution of wealth in this country, and the national minimum wage is so low, and so on. And it's virtually impossible for a family to survive with one adult working full-time if you have a low-wage job, and often even with two. And some of the stresses that families face really aren't solvable from inside the family. It's really a much larger social issue.
Well, yes and no. I mean, so what are you going to do? You're going to yell and scream and keep your stress to yourself and try to pretend it doesn't happen? You're not going to be good at masking that stress from your own family. So it's interesting, Sheryl Sandberg in Lean In talks about there being a chicken and an egg. So you're talking about a chicken problem, right, which is to say there's lots of things conspiring against families. There's lots of wage disparity. There's lots of economic challenges in the country. That is also true, but that doesn't mean we can't work on the egg. So I think that we need to be able to use a line from Barack Obama, we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. So one of the things that I did in the book, as you know, is tested a bunch of dinner table conversation games, if you will, and I picked the five or six that worked best with kids of different generations and grandparents and aunts and uncles visiting, etc. I dubbed them the Hunger Games, and I put them in the book. One of them that I like a lot is called Pain Points, P-A-I-N, Pain Points, where everybody goes around and talks about a struggle that they're having with a child. Maybe it's they have to do a project with a classmate at school they don't like. Maybe mom says, oh, I really want to go to your soccer game, but I need to take grandma to the eye doctor. Maybe dad or mom or anybody says, look, we have a choice. Are we going to be able to go on vacation this year, or am I going to be able to buy a nice birthday present for you? And you are openly talking about one of these challenges that are a real live economic challenge that every single family, no matter their income, faces. And suddenly, everybody at the table is throwing out ideas. You actually reduce your stress, and you give your children a more awareness of what you're dealing with, and you let them get engaged in their own, designing their own lives. So, look, you can't talk openly about everything, but I think bringing these issues about money, what kind of house do you want to live in? What's your fantasy? We had a fascinating conversation at dinner on Sunday night about if you gave money, would you want it to a donation? Would you want it to be anonymous, or would you want your name attached? Turned out to be a fascinating conversation as my kids kind of struggled with this issue of philanthropy. Bring these conversations out in the open. You'll be happy you did.
Bruce Feiler is author of the book, The Secrets of Happy Families. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you again for inviting me.
I am very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Marielle Nanasi. She is Executive Director of New Energy Economy, and Toner Mitchell, who is President of the Trutris Chapter of Trout Unlimited. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So this is a beautiful day. We're actually a couple days late in doing this, but I was out last week, and we have a wonderful piece of news, which I hope everybody's heard by now, which is that President Obama has designated Rio Grande del Norte National Monument as a basically gift to New Mexico. What happened? What area are we talking about, first of all?
We're talking about 240,000 acres, beginning roughly around Pilar, and with various inholdings throughout the stretch north of there all the way to the Colorado border.
And so what is this land like at this right now?
Right now, it's the sage is starting to get green, and the grass is starting to get green. We're getting a little bit of melt off, which is making some of that grass come out. And it's windy, of course, but that's northern New Mexico, as you know.
Is this a pristine area, or is this an area that needs some environmental restoration?
It's got a little bit of both. It's not necessarily pristine. It shows historical impacts of land use from very traditional land users from way back in history. So that's kind of a human artifact that's part of this place, and it's a beautiful part of this place. There is a little bit of land restoration that's gone on in terms of restoring sage land to grass, stuff like that. But generally, it's pristine, such as it is.
What kind of activities are happening there? Does anybody live there? Is it recreation land, fishing land?
Fishing, hunting, wood gathering, herb gathering, grazing. I think spiritual solace, which I think cannot be discounted. It's a very beautiful place, and it's powerful that way, and people need it for that.
Yeah, I was thinking of one thing in particular is that when, as we've been working on this for a long time now, we've just collected these stories, these real stories from people who have had celebrations there. I met a Native American woman who said, my grandparents, they got married at the Rio Grande del Norte, and people go there for, I was actually part of a wedding that was celebrated on the water, on the Rio Grande itself, so that was pretty exceptional. We all went out on canoes, and I think that there are lots of markers in life. I know even my own son, when he graduated from high school, took his best friend and said, I want to take you to the most beautiful place that I've ever been to and sleep under the stars. And so it's that.
And that's where it was?
Yeah, it was. It was on the Mesa up above the Rio Grande. And I think it has that power for people. People have talked about polishing their favorite pots with river stones. And just I think it's exactly what Toner said. It's a place of solace and magnificence.
Tell us about the wildlife in this area.
We have bighorn sheep, pronghorn antelope, elk, deer, mule deer, mountain lions, river otters. We have some kind of rogue cows that I've seen there since I was a young boy. Every now and then I'd go up and fish and I'd run into a kind of ornery bull here and there. We have brown trout, rainbow trout. We're trying to reestablish cutthroat trout in there, which is the state fish of New Mexico. Tons of wildlife, just tons. Great birds of prey.
What does it mean economically for the Rio Grande del Norte to be now a national monument? I mean, I'm sure that in this, and you can talk about the whole process of making this happen, but was there opposition to this monument who wanted to do other kinds of economic development there?
Not really, as far as we knew. There, every now and then there would be a whisper of opposition, but we could always refute it with the power of what the economics were really telling us.
Which is?
Which is that the monument would result in quite a few millions of dollars more in the local economy and some really nice stable jobs, too. Having to do with the tourist industry, you're going to get hotel beds filled. I'm a fishing guide, so the fishing industry is going to benefit. I think big job producers like Taos Ski Valley, that they are under increasing pressure to keep their operations profitable, and I think it brings a lot of people to their summer operations as well.
And you're talking about whitewater rafting and mm-hmm. climbing and horseback riding and all sorts of outdoor recreation activities.
Ballooning, even. Ballooning is very popular.
Yeah, I went hot air ballooning in the Rio Grande.
Very interesting. Now, one of the things that you talked about a moment ago is restoration of areas to grassland. I think a lot of people don't know that New Mexico was a huge grassland before, well, we started ruining it. You can restore land that has other species on it now and actually make it grassland again?
Yeah, I don't think anyone would try to attempt to restore it to its original state, but for getting a little more grass there, a little more diversity in the habitat, I think it can only help. It helps the grazers, certainly, and it helps wild grazers like elk and antelope and things like that. And it also helps the land hold water a little better
right.
if we vegetate more of the surfaces. Sagebrush often does not have vegetation between plants, and so you have a lot of bare soil there, a lot of erosion. So it's generally a good idea to rehab some of it.
We're talking to Toner Mitchell and Mariel Nanasi about the Rio Grande del Norte National Monument. Now, tell us some about the process of what it took to make this area designated a national monument.
Well, for years, there have been bills in Congress to try to designate this a permanently protected area. However, this last Congress was the very first Congress that didn't designate any wildlands at all, and in tens of years, I mean at least 50 or 60 years, and so then President Obama, under the Antiquities Act, which has been used by both Republican and Democratic presidents, designated five national monuments last week, and the Rio Grande del Norte was the largest of them all. And it's really just a super celebration for New Mexico on our centennial year, but particularly because the one unifying force in New Mexico is love of place, a love of nature. And so whether you are a newcomer or a Native American who's lived here for hundreds of generations, the awe that people feel when you see the rainbow or you see a river otter in the water or just the kinds of beautiful walking rain that you see out on the mesa where you have the big sky. That's the kind of love that people have, and that's why there was so much support for this. I don't think that I've ever worked on any campaign ever that had no opposition, and that was a remarkable feeling and really fun to do. And really this coalition, I have to just say, it was a coalition of a lot of different organizations. And that was really nice to see. People sort of lent their talents to this struggle to weigh in and really finally get President Obama to listen to us, the people. So the representatives were out there working it, and they had the real backing, the backing of the people.
So to get national monument status, it's an interesting process, because on the one hand, as you just said, Marielle, you have no opposition. There's nobody working against it. And on the other hand, you still have to get the attention of the President of the United States. A lot of different organizations were involved in making that happen.
There really were so many committed organizations. I would like to just highlight a couple, specifically New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and the Wilderness Society, and I think, and Trout Unlimited, and there were just, you know, organizations with real on-the-ground support that came to the fore and had people who were spokespeople who went out and did work, whether it was collecting signatures or bringing resolutions to the Taos County. Passed a resolution. The Santa Fe City Council passed a resolution unanimously, overwhelmingly. I mean, that's the kind of real support. And I don't know who else you wanted to give a shout out to, but it was really the depth of engagement that was that was sincere and powerful in this movement.
Yeah, I don't know so much that it was that I need to shout out to anybody, but what I learned from and appreciated through this whole process is pretty much not a ball was dropped. We did have opposition to this in the form of, unfortunately, a Republican Congress that was absolutely intransigent in Washington. So we had to take another approach. Nobody preferred Obama to have to do this, but it was our only way. And the best way to do that was to gather unanimous support and earn the support. And so we had a lot of people on the ground, like Mariel was saying, talking to councils, to the Taos Pueblo, to anybody who might have a separate opinion. We actually were digging very hard for opposition so that we could make the case. And the case was just so airtight that you know, we ended up not having opposition, but having people on the ground at every step of the way, gathering businesses up, talking to, you know, backcountry hunters and anglers were instrumental, New Mexico Wildlife Federation. We, Trout Unlimited, with those guys, we were working on the sportsmen, making sure the sportsmen were on board. We had people making sure that grazers were on board. We had people making sure businesses, tribes, like I said. So it was a very beautiful thing to watch.
So now we have a national monument, Rio Grande del Norte National Monument. And for more information, people can go to riograndedelnorte.org, or better yet, they can get on their car or bike and take a trip and enjoy this beautiful part of northern New Mexico.
Or white water raft.
Or yeah. White water raft.
That's how I would do it. I'd do it outdoors.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Mariel Nanasi is Executive Director of New Energy Economy. Toner Mitchell is President of the Truchas Chapter of Trout Unlimited. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.